Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. President Trump uses visual aids to show ISIS territory, quote, will be gone by tonight, end quote. President Trump earlier today used visual aids to argue that the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, also known as ISIS, would lose its remaining territory in Syria by tonight. The president used maps to show reporters what he called the success of his administration's fight against ISIS. He carried the visual aids as he departed the White House for a trip to Ohio. One map highlighted in red the parts of Syria that Trump said were held by the terrorist group on Election Day 2016. A second map showed present-day Syria with one small red spot. Trump in recent weeks has described the complete loss of ISIS territory in varying terms. In early February, he told representatives of the International Coalition Fighting the Terrorist Group that the U.S. would announce, quote, sometime probably next week, end quote, that, quote, 100% of the caliphate, end quote, had fallen. The Trump administration has offered shifting messages on its Syria plans, dating back to the president's December announcement that, quote, we have won against ISIS, end quote, and it's time for our troops to come back home. Trump said today that the U.S. will leave 200 troops in Syria and 200 people in another place in Syria, closer to Israel for a period of time. There are two takeaways for me from this. One, Minister Farrakhan said a number of years ago, never underestimate the blindness that attends arrogance. One does not see with his eyes. He sees with a combination of his heart and his mind. And one's mind blinds one to a reality that is right before their very eyes. I think this applies to President Trump's announcement. Also, so long as the global imperial hegemon called America continues to disregard the cultures, histories, and humanities of people around the world in order to steal their natural resources, the people in the lands wherein those resources reside will resist. It's just that simple. There are two stories involving the Boeing MAX 8 that we're going to cover right now. First, FAA approval of Boeing jet involved in two crashes comes under scrutiny, and the doomed Lion Air flight's pilots reportedly scoured the Boeing 737 MAX manual as the plane went down, trying to figure out how to solve the problem. The deeper they dig, the worse this becomes. For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He is qualified on a number of Boeing 737 airliners, also the Boeing 777, the 757, and the 727, Lockheed's L-1011s, and he has around 100 hours on the Boeing 900 MAX, around 10,000 hours in the 737, of which almost 7,000 are as a captain, and almost 25,000 total flying time hours. He is remaining anonymous for the sake of this conversation. He joins us again. Let me say, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's start with the FAA approval of Boeing jet involved in two crashes comes under scrutiny. As regulators at the FAA reviewed designs for Boeing's newest passenger jet, they paid extra attention to several features, including the lithium batteries, the pressure fueling system, and the inflatable safety slides. But one feature that did not receive exceptional scrutiny was the new software system intended to prevent stalls, what we now know as MCAS. Your thoughts, please.
Well, the way these airplanes are designed and manufactured and tested, the airplane is built by Boeing. Boeing builds a product. Then after Boeing builds a product, they go out and they test fly. They do things in these airplanes when they're test flying them that really push them to the absolute edge And for certification, the airplane has to get certified by Boeing. There's a committee and a policy of standards that the FAA has to see that the airplane meets in order to carry passengers for commerce and revenue. That same process applies in foreign countries. In order to fly in British airspace, German airspace, or other places around the world, you have to meet certain criteria, climb gradient, climb criteria on single engine, landing criteria, stopping criteria, stuff like that. And during this testing phase, which wasn't disclosed to any of you guys that I'm aware of, the airplane has a bigger engine underneath the wing that caused a different pitch moment when it was recovering from stall. So whoever was the principal operations inspector that said the airplane gets my stamp of approval, he wasn't satisfied with that. He said, you must do something to make this airplane meet this criteria without the pilot having to do more work or run out of an envelope to make this happen. To give you another example of the 777 has an engine on it that's enormous. The engine on a 777 is as big as the fuselage on a 737. When that airplane loses an engine, for you to physically put the rudder input in and maintain directional control, it can be done. But Boeing created a system called a thrust asymmetry computer because you couldn't do it fast enough. When that computer is active, you don't even know you lost an engine. It does it so perfectly, you feel like you're still flying a twin-engine airplane, but one engine is inoperative. So the FAA said, in order to make the idiot up front know that the airplane's lost an engine, we want you to desensitize that particular mechanism. This is the same type of scenario we're talking about here. So the engineers went back and designed the MCAS system that works when the airplane is manually flown, flaps are up, pitched upward, and indicating a close proximity to a stall. This system kicks in and pushes the nose over. Hey, you passed certification, you're good to fly to American public. Let's take it to Europe, let's take it to Asia, you're good to fly in those airspaces. Life goes on. They never put it in the book, so the average pilot can read it in his training process in order to learn how to fly the airplane, that if that system broke, how to go in and manage the airplane without it. That's where we had the deficiency at.
As I understand it, Airbus has, I think it's the A320neo,
correct,
which is similar to the Boeing MAX.
Correct.
But from what I understand, Airbus redesigned the airframe in order to accommodate the larger engines. Boeing didn't do that. Boeing just designed some software to solve the physics problem that was caused by the larger engine making the plane think that it's going into a stall. Is that, I know that's very, very elementary.
That's a very good analogy for it. It would give you the same scenario that happened that caused a deficiency in the industry in 1969 and 1970. Lockheed L-1011, most over-engineered airplane ever built, has technology in it from 1969 that we're flying today. That's how well the L-1011 was built. Lockheed has always been way ahead of the curve in building aircraft. They even admitted with the Skunk Works Department that there's stuff that you still don't have an idea that we made that's still going to blow your mind 100 years from now. So that's why people do believe that there's an SR-72 and all kind of other stuff out there. So the Lockheed L-1011 was designed, and McDonnell Douglas says, oh, my God, we have to develop a three-engine aircraft to meet the same characteristics that it needs to sell to the industry. And they put together the DC-10 really fast and put all three hydraulic systems in the back, and a cargo door blew off of it in France and killed everybody. All the hydraulics failed. Not long afterwards, American Airlines had a flight over Canada, blew the door open, hydraulics failed, the captain was able to get it on the ground. And then in Chicago in 1979, American Flight 191 took off, lost an engine, the whole engine tore off, airplane rolled 180 degrees, went to the ground, hydraulic system. That airplane is in the same situation and characteristics that we have now. Let's rush, put something together. Let's not over-design it. Let's fix it. Let's make it work. Hey, we're back in the financial market. So economics comes back into play, and we're back where we're standing again. The DC-10 suffered the stigma of that for years. Very nice airplane, flies beautiful, but after it was re-engineered, reorganized with the hydraulics and actually built better, it was able to compete against the L-1011, which had its deficiency then, which was the Rolls-Royce engine, that if the L-1011 program would not have been going on, Rolls-Royce would have went bankrupt. So in order to have Rolls-Royce stay in business, they built the L-1011 and kept that going. That was right before Nixon said the United States and the world was going to run out of oil and the energy crisis was going to come up, and 747s were hanging on a limb, and then they couldn't figure out if they were going to keep flying those. So they went from four engines to three engines to two engines to where we're at right now. Let's do two engines and put more automation in it, and let's get rid of the third pilot. And that's why the Celeste situation with Lion Air is where the third pilot played a very important role. But he was just riding. He was riding on the jump seat. And that jump seat gives you the best visibility to watch people make mistakes that they can't see themselves doing. And I've sat in that particular seat on many occasions commuting to work. When I was an engineer on the 727, I worked that seat, and my job was to make sure that the two guys up front wouldn't make mistakes that they wouldn't see. The computer took over that particular motion in that seat, and right now we're starting to go back down the path that we didn't want to go down. We're making mistakes, and we're not catching each other with them.
You mentioned Chicago 191. I was supposed to be on that flight.
Wow. I remember that day. I was a kid in grade school. I was in Maine.
I was coming back from the NCAA track championships in Chicago, in Illinois.
Wow.
And anyway,
wow.
So the same software, again, that was in Lion Air, also now is, you know, we're finding in the Ethiopian Air. Authorities around the world, they're taking a closer look at the jet's approval by the FAA, a process that relies heavily on Boeing employees to certify the safety of the plane. We talked about this the last time you were on with me. You've talked about it now, but what's wrong with the FAA process?
There's no oversight. The oversight comes from the committees in Washington. It comes from the lobbyists that make sure that their product gets pushed through properly. And when you're on a timeline to compete against an aircraft like the Neo that was beginning to be engineered a long time ago, Airbus is a consortium of European countries that have a whole lot more dollars and power to manufacture an airplane, in the sense that Airbus, in the eyesight of a person from the United States, is the Kia of the automotive industry. Fly them for 5 or 6 years, 8 years, and when they start to get to their high cycle life and they start to get to the high repetitionist life of the engines are getting timed on high time, you just park them in a desert and get a new one. Boeing's have a longevity and a more durability in their lifespans and their cycles because they're engineered well, they're built well, and they're marketed well. But they're engineered to the extent that computerization has taken over more than what the computerization has taken over in the Airbus fleet, per se, in that Boeing has always had hydraulics, and then you had cables to back it up. Now Boeing is wanting to transition from hydraulics to electrics.
Oh.
And have minimal cable capability, where Airbus is all electrics. Airbus is a stick in the front. It goes to an input box. It takes a signal and amplifies it through a wire. It receives it in another box, and it takes an amplification and tells a hydraulic unit to make that wing or that flap or whatever do what you want it to do up front. Boeing has a cable assembly that's controlled to a yoke that when you make a push forward, left or right, it goes to a pulley system that goes to the back that opens a port through a hydraulic system that does something. Now, Boeing is starting to reduce that, which means when you take these things out, you lessen the weight, which means you can put more revenue on board. And then Boeing takes that same mindset and says, let's go in and send it to a mixer box and send it to a hydraulic system to give it a little bit of assist, and let's reduce that system's weight. So we just took about 1,500 pounds, 2,000 pounds out, so you can add an extra 1,500 pounds in the ice chest in the back, or an extra seat or two, or maybe some extra cargo space. Economics.
The 737 MAX was one of the first commercial jets approved under new rules, which delegated more authority to Boeing than had been the case when most previous planes were certified. The software system did not raise warnings during the approval process. Top FAA officials who were briefed on the significant safety issues were not aware of the software system. This is according to folks that were knowledgeable of the process. In my opinion, the software requires as much scrutiny, if not more, than the hardware. I mean, just look at the iPhone rollouts. Look at the operating system for Windows and other software systems. None of them come to market bug-free. So what's to make people think that the MCAS system was going to be bug-free?
And we don't have an oversight committee in the FAA that specializes in looking at this. I mentioned earlier on the previous show, there was a time when a pilot was afraid of the FAA. I'm going to do my check ride next week. Oh, my God, I have to know everything in the book from front to back. You have to know every word. You have to know why every switch works. Nowadays, we don't do that anymore. The FAA is very, very soft. And when I'm speaking to the FAA, I'm not only talking about what we do in the airplane. The air traffic control system, we can have a whole show on that right now. The day that the government went back to work, there were some things that happened in the New York airspace that caused the FAA to say, hey, you need to stop this now because we're going to kill somebody. And there were some things that happened up there, and it stopped immediately. New York Center handles, and those controllers never get the respect and applause that they deserve. Those controllers in this country do a phenomenal job for the amount of stuff that we put on them. We show up at 350 knots of airspeed, dropping into airspace, coming 103 miles or 4 miles behind another airplane, anticipating the guy in front of me is going to slow down and do what he's going to do. And that controller sits there and works that process perfectly and hands it over to another guy he doesn't know. I'm talking to a stranger that's using technology that's old, 1960s, 1970s technology. I'm talking to a controller that works a three-hour shift, that isn't promised a high salary, that's been just jerked around by the federal government system, by a government shutdown, had nothing to do with him. He stayed to work and he still worked it. But he was worried that the technicians that worked on it, those are the guys that didn't show up to work and says, I'm not coming to work today. And that equipment's failing daily. I've been in the air in New York New York centers went off the air. We had nobody to talk to. But because of the experience level of the pilots that are flying in today's airspaces now, we know how to manage it. As a pilot today, I'm afraid that in another 10 years, we're not going to have those same caliber pilots in the air.
You mentioned the FAA. The president has nominated Stephen Dixon to head the FAA. President Trump, he announced that yesterday. He's a former executive at Delta, a former pilot, and he's replacing acting FAA Administrator Daniel Elwell. Your thoughts, if you want to comment on this process. You don't even have to mention Stephen Dixon personally, but just the way that this nomination process is being handled.
We've seen this before when Randy Babbitt took over. And when pilots take over jobs that they know mandate a lot of change, change is money. The FAA has to govern the money from budgets that have to come from a system that's already strained. They don't get the money. The process doesn't change. I don't think he's going to be around long myself. He was successful at Delta as a pilot, as a manager, whole different aspect. To come into a governance position in this particular avenue, and a lot of pilots are talking about it right now, we're wondering what kind of friendship or what kind of bargains were done in the past. Pilots are not impressed with the fact that this president is looking to come to somebody in the industry to do this because he once owned an airline, and he did not run it properly. He got involved in running an airline where you don't do that. People that run in that particular garment of the industry don't tell people that do our jobs how to do it. They don't have an idea, don't have a clue. And the shuttle didn't last long. Unfortunately, in saying that, the Trump shuttle, which was the Eastern shuttle prior to that, the U.S. Air shuttle, always made money until he took it over. The most lucrative business corridor in the United States, Boston, Washington National, and LaGuardia, mm-hmm. always made money. Pan Am had a shuttle, Delta had a shuttle, Eastern. When he took it over, it didn't make money. So I don't take wisely on any choices that he makes, that he studied them well enough and understands it. And having another guy come in here, he's going to see what he's overwhelmed with. He's going to request funding for it. He's going to request drastic change. And when you can't talk to Boston, which hasn't been successful by even the United States three-star, four-star general, he ain't going to last long. And that's the current pulse in the crew rooms right now. We're laughing at it, basically saying, why don't you just shut up and let people that know how to do their jobs? It's not going to happen. And usually it takes an accident in this industry to change the industry. And that's how our history's been shown.
And we know repeatedly with a number of appointments and nominations that he's put forth, he has a tendency to put people in positions that either A, have no experience in the field, or B, have articulated politics and policies that are contrary to the mission of the agency that he's put them in, such as EPA and other places. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to an anonymous pilot about this Boeing MAX 8 issue. And there's another issue that we're going to cover here when we come out of this break. Doomed Lion Air Flight's pilots reportedly scoured the Boeing 737 MAX manual as the plane went down. You are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's a lot more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And we're talking about the Boeing 737 MAX planes and the problems. And you all know now that those planes have been grounded internationally. We have an anonymous pilot who has experience in the cockpit of that plane. And I want to move to another issue. There's a story, doomed Lion Air flight's pilots reportedly scoured the Boeing 737 MAX manual as the plane went down. New information has emerged about the crash late last year of Lion Air Boeing 737 MAX 8 jet in Indonesia that suggests the crew was ill-prepared to deal with a problematic new MCAS flight control system. Data from the other so-called black box, the cockpit voice recorder, suggests the flight crew didn't even understand what they were fighting and may have had no idea how to override the malfunctioning MCAS software system. Sir, your thoughts?
Well, every airplane has the same capability today, right now, flying over the skies, to have the same runaway stabilizer trim issue. Every pilot has been in the United States, now I might make that note, every pilot I know has been exposed to this in order to get a certification on flying the aircraft. And we don't know what those guys and those training scenarios and those training that training world that Lion Air had, we don't know what they were exposed to or where they were trained from. Naturally, you would know if the stabilizer trim wheel turns for over 5 to 10 seconds, the whole stabilizer, it's a big wing back there with an empennage attached to it, which are the elevators that tell you to go up and go down. If that thing moves that much, it's actually setting the pitch angle or the motion for the nose of the aircraft to be in the upward or downward position. Apparently, they fought this thing for 12 minutes and did not know to reach down and turn those two switches off and manually take the wheel and turn the wheel and reset and stabilize and fly the airplane. That is a training issue. That is on the fault of the company, but it's also on the fault of whoever certified them to fly the plane, but it's also on the fault of Boeing not to make it notable to them that you need to know how to do this before you fly the airplane. That's what we have in international operations in foreign countries, unfortunately. We don't know what they've been exposed to, but they're just adequately fine to fly to Kennedy, LaGuardia, fly to Miami, to Los Angeles, San Francisco any day of the week and fly right over your homes and land. I don't know where those guys were trained.
I just can't imagine the sense of panic that is going through the hearts and the minds, first of the pilots and then later for the passengers, as the pilots are thumbing through the index of the manual saying, where's the section on this problem? Where's the section?
It was not a comfortable ride. Apparently, from reading some of the transcript, 11 to 25 degrees nose pitch up, 30 to 40 degrees nose pitch down, 40 degrees nose pitch up. And when you're doing this, your physical sensation and your G-forces on your body, your weight is being thrust around. It's not a comfortable feeling. We have in our aircraft and most aircraft when they're certified, what's called a quick reference hand guide. And it's tabulated with over 25 or 35 different systems. So you immediately go to those actions. First, you stabilize the emergency. You fly the airplane. Always fly the airplane. If you're not flying the airplane is flying you. You're a passenger. Stabilize the aircraft. Do emergency action items, memory items. This was not a memory item for them. For us, it is. And then after it's stabilized, you go to the quick reference hand guide. While one guy flies the plane, the other guy reads the item. We have iPads in the cockpit now where we can automatically tab to these particular items. In that scenario, especially if it was nighttime or early morning, you can't see it well enough because you're jerked around and moving around too much to see it. So it wasn't a very comfortable situation and scenario. The quick reference hand guy stabilizes the situation and then gets it under control where the other guy then, one pilot flies, the other guy identifies, is it the right one or the left one, and then shuts the engine down or shuts down the system or it goes through the process and you verify and you fly the aircraft. That's why we have two pilots. About 6 months to a year ago, the industry was trying to talk the FAA and allowing aircraft to fly pilotless. Federal Express and UPS were trying to push hard to say, we can have this aircraft with a bunch of boxes in the back that's expendable and let it take off with nobody on it. Drones do this all the time. Aircraft uses drones all the time. Tyndall Air Force Base right top of Pensacola and north of Tampa, there's a warning area out there that nobody flies through. And when it's active, you don't fly through it because they launch drone fighter jets and other fighters. That's why they teach fighter pilots how to shoot down airplanes. They go out and do live weapon firings and shoot down aircraft. And they're shooting down F-16s and old F-4s and F-100s that were sitting in the desert. they set them up with servos and a remote control, they fly them out there and do that. It can be done. But when these type of scenarios happen, how do you stabilize it? That's the problem. Man has to be involved in there to physically interact. And that psychological event has to come forth under that point. You have to use a quick reference guide to stabilize the emergency. And United 232, the day I made captain, I had a chance to meet Captain Al Haynes. And I asked him, I said, do you have any advice for me? He says, I'm going to tell you one thing right now, son, and never forget it. Always be the captain and always fly the airplane.
Wow.
Take ownership of what you do. And when I sign for an airplane, I am responsible for the airplane. Anything goes wrong, you break your fingernail, somebody yells at you, whatever, I get asked the question, what happened? And when that airplane's flying, if that flight wasn't comfortable, the flight wasn't safe, they ask me what was going on. So that captain's fully responsible. And that means when you're home and you're off work, you're still responsible to read the bulletins, to read the informational pages, to stay on top of the characteristics, to change the weather. You're still responsible for it.
When I spoke with you before we went on air, you said, I'm preparing my schedule. I'm preparing for next week. So,
I'm flying to Panama.
It was reported that the pilots could be heard frantically scouring the quick reference guide to figure out why the jet was going into the dive. The recording apparently includes audio of the pilot speculating about a problem with the plane's airspeed controls, but not the MCAS system. That goes right back to your point about training. Separately, Bloomberg reported yesterday that the same Lion Air plane that crashed on October 29th may have narrowly avoided a crash the previous day. But thanks to a pilot that was hitching a ride in the cockpit who correctly diagnosed the problem and told the flight crew how to fix it, it was a separate flight crew. But to your earlier point, that's the guy or woman in the third seat.
Yeah, that was the person riding what we call the jump seat. It's a fold-down seat. And when we get a jump seat rider, usually the company personnel gets first preference to it. The FAA gets first preference. Maintenance can have a preference to it. It's up to the captain's discretion if he wants you to sit in that seat and observe. When you're sitting in that seat below 10,000 feet in the United States, we call it a sterile cockpit. Nobody talks, okay? But I always make it known to the jump seater. I do the briefing with my first officer, and I make it known to the jump seater. This is my first officer's name is Michael. My name is Blank. And if you see something, you smell something, you hear something, tell me. Tell me. Speak up, because his eyes are seeing what I can't see. He's sitting in between two gigantic circuit breaker panels. He can hear a circuit breaker pop that I can't hear. He can smell things. I have a keen sense for smell that when the flight attendants are fixing the meals in first class, if I smell smoke, I automatically pick up the phone and ask them, are you guys cooking? Never want a fire on an airplane. Not the place to have it. Usually they tell me, yes, we are. There's paper in the oven. It was burning from a previous flight or whatever. Or I spilled some cheese in the oven and it's smelling. If I don't hear them saying something's not good, I'm looking for a circuit breaker that's popped or something going wrong. That's normal. I hate to say this again, but some guys that come from on the other side of the world sometimes, they don't do this. We study accidents and incidents where we listen to them say, what is that? And the computer comes on saying, terrain, too low, terrain. It's telling you too low, you're going into the ground. What is it doing? Terrain.
Wow.
He heard the airplane tell him, you're going into the ground. You're going into terrain. Too low means you're not climbing and descending. And they look at each other and ask questions. We spend a day, usually a half a day, in what we call human factors classes, talking about these things. And in those human factors classes, we review, what can we do to make this better? After every flight I have this week, I had a discussion with my first officer. How was this flight? Okay, yeah, we were good. We're always good. We're the greatest. We're the best. What can we do to make it better? Well, yesterday I had some weather over Florida I had to deal with and was going to Costa Rica and made some decisions. He wanted to go right. I decided to go left. Well, at that point, I'm the captain. I go where we want to go. When we came out of the weather, he realized he wasn't right and I was right. We would have went right. We would have went right into a building thunderstorm. We got down to Costa Rica and they gave us a really high rate of descent, unstable approach. And I broke the approach off and asked the controller to reinitiate me back into the area, to come back in and land where I was stable. And there's certain criteria we use in the United States now that we want to stop the renegade cowboy flying. We want to, under 10,000 feet, we want to have our speeds to where we're controlling it. In the terminal control area within 5 miles of the airport, we want to have the aircraft configured and slow to a slower value. once we're starting down, we don't want our vertical rate of speed, or what we would call feet per minute, to be greater than 1,000 feet per minute. If you're descending under 1,000 feet and you're doing 5,000 feet per minute, that means in a matter of a couple of seconds, you're in the ground. I don't want to be less than 500 feet per minute. So in 1 minute, I'm going to lose 500 feet. So I got a lot of time now to see the ground getting bigger. So we want to be in these characteristics. This controller had me closing into the ground pretty at a high rate of speed and still not configured and slowing. I didn't like it. I told him I want to break it off and go. And then when we did get lower, the winds picked up a lot stronger, which he didn't tell us that they were gusting. And we ended up deciding we were getting ready to do a go-around. I salvaged the landing and put the airplane on the ground. Yeah, I was asking the controller to help us to stabilize the descent. And down there, they just give you the clearance and the approach. They don't care if you're going fast or slow, how you're working out.
Wow.
Yeah, they don't. It's a whole different world down there. You don't have people don't realize you don't have an 8-foot fence. There's a lot of things you give up when you leave out of the United States. We have some good stuff, but right now we're not regulating. We're not mandating as good as we used to.
You sent me some photographs.
Yes.
And the Boeing 737 MAX pilots can flip just two switches to override the MCAS system. And I think you sent me a photograph of those switches.
Yeah.
So if I understand this right, they could have just simply solved the problem when they realized that the nose of the plane was pitching erratically. Mm-hmm. They could have flipped two switches and problem solved?
Absolutely. And those are the same two switches on the 800 all the way to the 300 to the 200, the same switches on the 727, the same two switches on the 757, the 767, it's a stabilizer and trim. Autopilot motor and the main stabilizer trim motor. Same switches.
But how does that apply with the MCAS system being new and just in the 737 MAX?
Considered the master circuit breaker for that system.
Ah.
What it does is it turns power off to the main motor that system controls. So the system is going to keep sending signals to the motor. The motor isn't going to work.
The motor won't listen because the switches have been turned off.
Absolutely. It has nothing to do to work for it. All of Boeing's airplanes are built upon years of technology, 60s, 70s, 80s. And the funny part about the 737 is Boeing took the 757, the 76, and the 777, and the 78, and they have what they call crossbar switches, where you push a switch in and a light illuminates straight across it. The 737 and the 727 had toggle switches with a big white cap on it. So you go in there, if you hit your head on the top of it, you get an indentation, sometimes a bruise. They never changed the switchology of it. If the switch is forward, it's on. If it's backwards, it's off. The only airline that changed that switchology was TWA. Howard Hughes had them all rigged backwards because if you bought the airplanes, you had to spend money to change them over.
Mm.
A lot of people didn't know that. He had them all rigged backwards. And then another thing about Boeing airplanes that makes them simple for third world countries, the panels are painted gray. The dark panels are the panels you touch if you lose an engine or you have an emergency. And they are cracked. They cat a corner. And they also illuminate it with the translucent liquid behind them that if you push them where there's a little crossbar at, they illuminate at night. That's a Boeing thing. We all know that. That's why we like Boeing. They're built solid. They're good. They're the kick worth of the highway. And, you know, the thing is, they come up with something. They don't tell anybody about it. Guess what? You lost your get-out-of-jail card now. Shame on you.
Are you a golfer?
I just drive. I don't play the game and stuff. I just get out and drive and range.
Well, okay, because say you have a slice in your swing and the ball. So now they have golf clubs that they design that will help to take the slice out of your swing.
Okay.
I say, don't buy the golf club, fix the swing.
Right.
So I'm using that as the analogy here. They had a mechanical problem with their aircraft. And instead of fixing the problem, they tried to override the problem with a software fix. But they didn't tell the pilots how to manage the system. That, to me, is borderline criminal.
Pilots are built of egos. You don't tell pilots they're terrible, and they don't tell you that they're terrible, too. And one thing pilots have never done is talk back to Boeing and say, we can't keep up with your technology curve. Third world countries aren't going to do that. They're going to say, hey, we'll figure it out, and they learn it as they go. This time, they didn't learn it as they went because they weren't given information to basically build upon to start with.
I just said in the previous segment, never underestimate the blindness that attends arrogance.
Absolutely, and it comes down to arrogance. One thing about pilots, we love big watches. They never tell you what time's on it. I've seen guys, and this is serious, I've seen guys with gigantic, brittling watches that did not work.
I've seen that too.
didn't work. But he had a Brennelly on.
Right.
He looks in his bag, you know, on his iPhone to see what time it is. But he's the captain, and, you know, same guy took us on a boat and asked us for money to buy gas to get it back to the shore, too. But, you know, he was special.
But, in wrapping this up, how do you see this whole thing playing out? What is it going to take to get these airplanes back in the air?
Okay, step one, Congress is going to call Boeing on the carpet, and they're going to yell at them real hard. And you're going to have some oversight. You're going to have a war within Congress about, well, that's going to cost too much of money. Well, that's a Democratic move. That's a Republican. It has nothing to do with that. Boeing is going to get yelled at real hard. Boeing is going to take the bullet from McDonnell Douglas, who they absorb. Airbus is looking at it on the other side. And when Airbus products come to the United States for certification, they're going to go through a more stringent certification process, which is going to make them make a better product as well. The MD-80, I'm going to make you remember this. Alaska Airlines MD-80 crashed off the coast of Santa Barbara.
Yes.
Had a jack screw problem. That was a stabilizer that broke on that. Same thing. Same mechanism. The motor worked, the stabilizer jack screw worked, but it stripped because nobody was inspecting it. We had the same problem on airplanes that the airline I flew for. They found them with the inspections. You guys didn't know that.
To your point about Congress calling Boeing on the carpet, here's the key. The 737 MAX, it's the best-selling jet. There are more than 4,600 pending orders, which are worth hundreds of billions of dollars in the coming years.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that Congress is going to do everything they can do to do the minimal amount to save those hundreds of billions of dollars.
I agree. And the thing that Congress is going to do is they're going to provide oversight. They're going to have more faces. I don't know if you heard this one as well. Boeing has had some structural failures in the issues of quality control here recently. The KC-43 tanker, which is the 767-200, there was a competition going on for a long time to use the Airbus A330 or the KC-43, 767-200. Boeing was given an award because military generals said, I'll never let a foreign entity fuel an American airplane going into a battle scenario. So the Air Force started taking deliveries on the airplane. Look this one up. This is recent. Didn't make the news that big, but I knew guys that were in squadrons that were waiting on the airplane. You know what they found in the airplane? Airplane wasn't combat ready. They found wrenches and towels and tennis shoes and all kind of stuff in the fuel tanks. Quality control didn't catch it. So the Air Force refused delivery on the airplanes. Boeing has got to answer to that one.
Tennis shoes and towels in the fuel tank.
Yeah, because you can walk in the center fuel tank of some of these airplanes. It's just that big. You're looking at 40,000 gallons of fuel sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, nuts and bolts and pieces of things left behind. Somebody didn't do the right quality control. When the 787 was being built, they built a factory in South Carolina. There was a lot of rift about it because the Carolina factory isn't union. The Seattle factory is union. Them boys wasn't getting along too good. I'm going to put a in this particular piece of when I do it and see if they catch it. And they didn't catch it a couple of times. And that had some quality control issues. They started to rush stuff off the production line. Boeing, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe upon recently, and this is the thing I want you to note and listeners know, Boeing was a leading exporter for the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
Not Ford, not Chevrolet,
right.
Not Hewlett-Packard, anything else. It was Boeing. And we got a lot of catching up to do. And I swear, they built a very good product. I've taken it through a lot of things, and it's brought me on the ground, and I've walked away. But I don't have any doubts about it. But I'm really starting to get irritated at the fact that you don't value my life as much as I value your product.
Wow. Let me stop you there. Thank you so much again for coming to the Critical Hour. Greatly appreciate your contribution to the quality of this program. And stay safe up there.
Will do.
Thank you. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Disney moves from behemoth to colossus with the closing of the Fox deal. Should we be concerned about continued media consolidation with this merger? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She is the Executive Vice President of Odyssey Media. She's the co-chair of Internet Innovation Alliance and senior adjunct professor at George Washington University School of Law. She is Kim Keenan. Ms. Keenan, welcome to the Critical Hour.
I'm so excited to be a part of the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much. So this morning, just after midnight on the East Coast, the Walt Disney Company closed its $71.3 billion acquisition of 21st Century Fox assets. It is now an entertainment colossus, the size of which the world has never seen. What does this mean to you? As consumers of entertainment and media, should the public be concerned?
Well, I definitely think it's something the public always has to keep their eye on because, you know, what is driving all this media sort of consolidation and all of these sort of mergers is the fact that content is becoming king and people want more and more. And as we move to 5G in terms of, you know, our how we communicate with each other and how we get our information, it is going to require that people have more because they're going to get it bigger, better, and faster. And so the companies are looking ahead, and the truth of it is they're not really competing in the way that we thought they would be competing. They're more competing as they look at the marketplace and say, companies like Amazon are putting people out of business. Right? They're putting people out. So they're not really competing. Like when you see this deal, you're thinking, oh, this is competition against some other big media company. But really, it's the company saying, where are people going to be? I need to get there. And the bigger companies have the ability to say, okay, these are the things I need to add to my portfolio. So a streaming service for Disney is a new business. It's not the same business they were in. It's a whole new business. So when they start acquiring television studios and movie studios, now they're saying, okay, we're not just going to create the content. We're going to distribute the content ourselves. We're going to do it all. And it's not horizontal, it's vertical.
That takes me, you just went about four questions deeper into my, which is cool because here's the thing. This question I think will allow you to elaborate a little bit more. Do you see the advancements in technology impacting this growth as Disney is now trying to become less dependent on cable channels like ESPN, which are in slow, steady decline due to people cutting the cord? Disney has decided to move into the rapidly growing realm of online video, a direct-to-consumer business that Netflix has brought to the table.
Well, absolutely. And that, I mean, what I'm talking about is the driver. Like, what is driving this? So you, in fact, you've already started talking about those things. So why is ESPN in freefall? It used to be one of the most powerful, right? If you didn't get ESPN on your cable network, you were like, I don't need this cable because
absolutely
I don't
right.
have ESPN, right?
Absolutely right.
Okay, right. I don't think there's a man on earth that wouldn't have said that, right? If I can't get it, then we can't have it. So they were like king of the hill. But see, now that we have cord cutting and you have all these young people who are like, I don't want to have to sit somewhere and plug in something and go through a box and do all these different things. But I can watch everything I want to watch on my phone.
And I don't want to do it at 9 o'clock. I don't want to be forced to do it
right.
at 9 o'clock.
Exactly.
I want to do it when I want to do it.
On demand. On demand. On demand is the other factor here. They want it the way they want it, when they want it, how they want it. And that drives so many parts of this conversation. So, you know, it's so funny when you were talking about what I do, you notice I have all these different aspects to what I do because the technology is driving how we do what we did. And so when you see a deal like the Disney deal or you see AT&T talking about the Time Warner deal, what you're really seeing is people saying the technology is going to disrupt bigger, better, and faster than it has at any other time. And so they're really, the truth is what you see people doing is struggling to be on the curve of where they're going because you know, one day, I mean, think about this. Look at all these stores you see all around you closing. You see Sears.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You see, it's like every day there's a new store, and it's because they are not trying to keep up. They're trying to do, you know, what my mentor used to say, If you keep doing what you've been doing, you're going to keep getting what you got. And so it's really important that they all try to stay ahead of this curve, because a lot of stuff is going to be literally wiped out, not because they're smaller, but because they haven't thought through where are people going to be in the near-term future. And the truth of it is, just what you said, they're going to be on these streaming services because people want what they want, when they want it, the way they want it, how they want it. And 5G is going to take us there. I think at the bottom of all these conversations, you'll hear people more and more talking about, you know, the difference between being on 4G and being on 5G. And a lot of people don't sense that, right? These are the different generations. So, right, 1G is what we grew up with when we were kids. And, you know, I called you on a telephone and you answered. Okay. 2G, we start to, you know, be able to do it portably, right? 3G, now we can text. Right. Now, 2G, you started the texting. Now you're texting and you're getting some video. And now 4G, you've got video, you've got texting, you're cord cutting. But 5G is that much stronger of a game changer. It's bigger. It's better. It's smarter. It'll be on demand. You know, I still remember when I was a young lawyer, I would take depositions and we would be like at the Kinko's, and it would be like those kung fu movies where you'd say something and then it would be like 3 minutes before somebody knows what you actually said, and then they would respond and you would wait. Oh no, this is all going to be instantaneous. So when we talk about a 5G generation, what we're really saying is it's going to be bigger, better, and faster than anything we can really imagine. Truth is, I think most people don't even know what all we'll be doing.
I've been talking about 5G, and I've been beating the drum that most people think that 5G is just faster 4G. They don't understand that this is the next leap in technology. This is going from the two tin cans connected by the string to using the internet. This is the Internet of Things.
10 times faster, 100 times faster. This is yep.
Okay.
More, bigger, better, faster than we ever imagined.
So let me ask you this. This was totally off script, but let me ask you this, because I've been trying to find somebody to answer the question. I think I finally did. So a couple of months ago, China announces that they were able to put a rover on the dark side of the moon. So there's this dune buggy now that's riding around on the dark side of the moon. And everybody was marveling at this. I was saying, you all are missing the point. It's not that there's a dune buggy riding around the dark side of the moon. It's the communication technology that China was able to implement. It's that satellite that's out there that enables right. China to communicate with that dune buggy so it can drive where they want it to drive and they can see what they want to see. And there are still, like, what? A quarter of the world, if not more, doesn't have access to the internet. That's what right. this dune buggy was about on the dark side of the moon. It wasn't about a car riding around bumping into stuff in the dark.
Absolutely. Well, let me give you some points to add to that. I agree with you that the ability to harness that technology and use it in ways that people never imagined, right? We don't send people up there to discover what the bad things are going on the moon that we don't know about. We send the dune buggy mm-hmm. and it sends us back a picture and we know what happens. I mean, I really feel more and more like we're in the Star Wars pictures. And I always talk about how the thing about Star Wars or Star Trek is whenever you want to get rid of somebody and you don't want to just kill them, you send them to the dark planet, right? You send them to the planet where there's no technology. And nobody can communicate with you, right? I love that, because it's something that everybody, no matter how old you are or how young you are, you can relate to. And this is why it's so important that we, one, make sure that our people and our communities have access to the internet. And I mean full access. I mean the ability for the educational tools, for the technological tools, for the make your life easy tools. But let me tell you this, and I think it's going to put a little twist on what you said. I agree with you about China and the moon, but we are ahead of them on 5G. Now, I'm not saying we're going to stay there. I'm not saying that they're not going to commit to 5G, but I'm saying that America is poised to do what it does best and innovate faster. You know, we have hurdles that other countries don't have, but more and more you're going to see these 5G conversations bubbling up all over and cities really clamoring because
you know, in order for 5G to work as well as we, you and I are discussing, it means that there's going to be, you know, these small cells that have to be deployed, because in order for the signal to move that fast, it's got to be able to ping through all those small cells quickly, and they have to be enough of them to speed up that process. So, you know, China's doing that. And I don't know that we have a rover there, but I do believe that as we sit here today, we are ahead of China in the 5G race.
Why is it that everything I'm reading is telling me that China is way ahead of us? They're ready to deploy 5G now, and the United States has been traversing the world trying to convince Europe not to allow China to do that because we're behind the eight ball.
Yeah, I think it depends on, you know, what specifically people are talking about. And you have to remember, our network is, you know, we really have like the best ultimate test of how you deploy something like this, because our country has every kind of terrain imaginable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that presents a challenge, but it also presents an opportunity.
China's not just flat, though.
No. I know they have mountains and things, too. But okay. What I was going to say to you, I was not prepared to talk about that topic today.
I understand.
I guess what I'm upset about is I would have something for you. I could probably pull up a couple things to let you see. I mean, a lot of what you get is where you get it from and how you get it. But I do think that America will always have more challenges as it relates to regulation and, you know, does this city want the small cells or do they not want this? You know, are they motivated to get the small cells or not? So we have hurdles that, you know, in China, if whoever gets up in the morning and says we're going to have them, we have them. People just put them up. They don't ask no questions. There's no whole talk about it. But I do think that in terms of innovation, you know, we really always have the stronghold because our people demand the innovation. In other words, our stuff bubbles up. So the companies have to keep up and they have to do it faster. So even though it may not seem on the surface that we're ahead on this race, I think if you really analyze company to company and how it's deployed, I don't know that China is ahead of us in 5G. I don't know that I can agree with that.
Well, since I didn't mean to take you into an area that you weren't prepared to discuss, so let's, in our driverless car, we'll move back over to the left lane.
I love it.
We'll move back over to the left lane.
That will be much better because it's powered by 5G technology.
So the New York Times writes that the ripple effects of this merger may not become clear for years. Analysts say that Disney could force smaller studios to merge as they scramble to compete. It will have greater leverage over theater owners when it comes to box office splits, and Disney plans to use the Fox content to forcefully move into streaming and could slow the growth of Netflix. Now, in terms of the dangers posed by conglomerates and monopolies, you know, we go back to 1911 and the Supreme Court, the Standard Oil v. New Jersey case that broke up Standard Oil under the Sherman Antitrust Act. We've got the split up of AT&T, but all of this seems to be cyclical, and these breakups and reconsolidations, again, as Disney is now becoming the biggest player, the conglomerate on the block, it's now like the Leviathan.
Yeah, I mean, I won't disagree in the sense that, you know, they are such a big beast. I mean, let's be honest. Disney is like prolific. I mean, right? They you know, when you think about having a child and what they're going to see over the first 10 years of their life,
right,
Disney is in every frame of that picture. But this is really...
Oh, wait a minute. Quickly to that point. When we were children, we were watching, and I believe I'm a lot older than you. I'm a generation ahead of you, I would say. And I was watching Disney in the 60s, and you were watching Disney. So my point is, it's not only kids today, it's what we have been watching over the course of the last 70 years.
Right, right. And I mean, people think of Disney as sort of like children's entertainment, But Disney is so much more than that. I mean, you know, all you need to do is see what the Disney cruise is, and it sounds to me like it's a cruise for adults.
Right.
They have vacation for the kids. So I mean, you know, it shows you how forward thinking they've been about what their brand is and what it does. So, you know, I see that as not a surprise that they have moved into this because, they, I mean, it's like, where else would they go? And I think in terms of antitrust, what you also have to analyze is there's a difference between vertical and horizontal integration. And
gotcha.
I think that's the issue, that this is really more for them vertical than it is horizontal.
And let me jump in real quick because we're up against the clock and I want to get this point in. Very few people are talking about the international aspects of this as well, because European countries, their anti-monopoly laws, and Latin American companies, such as who's going to broadcast soccer games and all that kind of stuff, there's a huge international component to this as well.
Well, they, you know, they had to back off of the British component, right? They would have been able to get British pay TV as a part of this. And, of course, Britain, you know, was kind of like, no. But the difference between Britain and Mexico is if there was only, you know, one or two, and now you're going to be the biggest beast on the planet, then for them it really is, it's our old antitrust issue. But in America, they're not the only one. Like you said, they're now competition for Netflix. Netflix didn't have competition for a really long time. People don't realize that, but you know, when they decided not to be a store where you rented videos anymore, they did a lot of disruption, and they did a lot of stuff that if they hadn't been New Kid on the Block, they wouldn't have been able to do. And as you point out, in the cycle of life of a business that wants to hang out, they are now facing the tradition, you know, all the things they fought against from the big companies that did entertainment and media a certain way. Now it's coming back on them, where people are, you know, saying, well, we can stream it too. We can stream it too. And they're having to make decisions. Do I share my content with another streaming service, or do I just only have my own streaming service? And I think what you'll find is that different companies are going to answer that question differently.
And again, in a lot of the articles I read, the one thing that was not mentioned to the degree that you got into it, and I really appreciate you doing so, is the technology. This 5G thing is going to be a beast. Well, senior adjunct professor at the George Washington School of Law and executive vice president of Odyssey Media, co-chair of Internet Innovation Alliance, Kim Keenan. Kim, thank you so much for your time today. You really added value to the Critical Hour.
Well, I so appreciate that. Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Look forward to having you back.
Take care.
All right, folks, you have been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.